clamped with a series of U-bolts to the anchor chains. Ordinarily, a small crew would remain on board a derelict under tow, but without knowing to what extent the fire had ravaged the hull, there was too great a danger for the men to remain on board the Emerald Dolphin. If she should abruptly head for the sea floor, they might not have time to escape and would be sucked down with her. Finally, McDermott gave the order for dead slow ahead. First Mate Arl Brown, who was operating the gigantic tow winch, paid out the cable until the cruise ship was a good quarter of a mile astern. Then he set the brake. The slack went out of the cable, and the winch took up the strain as the Audacious began to inch forward. 10 hours later, the Audacious's big engines were towing the enormous hulk at a respectable 2 knots. Most of the fire was out. Only a few flickers of flame could still be seen in the dark night amid the twisted wreckage of the superstructure. The crew took turns on watch, making sure the big tow followed behind as planned. After midnight, the ship's cook took his turn. 2 hours later, he was barely awake, fighting off drowsiness with his 10th cigarette and 3rd Pepsi. Suddenly he heard what sounded like a deep rumble come from within the hulk of the Emerald Dolphin. The cook's face froze in horror. The Emerald Dolphin was foundering, and she looked to be going down fast. In shock, he ran up onto the bridge to shout, "She's sinking! Holy Mother, she's going under!" McDermott heard the commotion and burst from his cabin. One look was enough to tell him that if they didn't cut the tow cable, the sinking liner would take the Audacious and her crew 20,000 feet to the sea floor. Frantically, they struggled to release the brake, paying out the massive cable, watching it unreel into the abyss, rapidly falling from a near-horizontal angle to vertical as the cruise ship buried her bow in the water. The great cable that was wound around the winch's drum began to unreel ever faster until it became a blur. McDermott and Brown could only hope that when the cable finally unwound, its end would rip from its connectors. If not, the Audacious would be pulled under. The dead cruise ship was plunging with uncanny speed. Already her bow was diving beneath the surface. The stern hung for a few seconds, and then slowly it followed the bow into the black sea, until the entire ship plummeted out of sight, leaving a great swelling of air bubbles. Only one row of cable remained wound around the reel, but suddenly it became taut, and the stern of the tug dipped abruptly, jerking the bow out of the water. There came an ear-splitting shriek, and then the end of the cable shot off the drum and whipped out of sight into the sea. Released from the strain, the tug's bow came down hard as she righted herself, rocking on her keel forward and aft before settling down. The crew stood in stunned silence at their narrow brush with death. Finally, Brown muttered, "I never believed a ship could sink in the blink of an eye."
"Nor I," McDermott agreed. "It's as though her entire bottom dropped out."
Then McDermott paused and held up a hand. "Listen," he said sharply. Everyone gazed at the spot where the Emerald Dolphin had vanished. Out of the night, a voice was shouting,
"Help me!"
Brown ran over to the searchlight, swung it around, and played its beam on the water. The dark face of a man could barely be seen against the ebony sea less than 100 feet off the stern.
"Throw him a line," Brown ordered a crewman, "and haul him in before the sharks get him."
The rope was heaved over the side. The man caught it, and 2 crewmen pulled him to the stern and heaved him aboard. He was a dark-skinned man who wore a ship officer's uniform. Hardly expecting to see a survivor this late in the game, McDermott looked at the man questioningly.
"May I ask where you came from?"
The stranger unleashed a wide-toothed smile.
"I thought that was obvious. I am, or rather was, the Emerald Dolphin's passenger relations officer. I fell and struck my head while helping passengers onto the research vessel. Everyone must have thought I was dead and left me. When I woke up, you had the ship under tow.
My name's Sherman Nance." After Nance was escorted below by the cook, Brown peered at the captain.
Uncanny that he survived a fire of such magnitude without a singed eyebrow or a burned finger.
McDermott rubbed his chin doubtfully.
Yes, uncanny.
Then he sighed. It's not our concern. I now have the distasteful duty of notifying the directors that we lost our tow and their expensive cable. As soon as the Audacious reached Wellington, New Zealand, the man McDermott had pulled from the sea disappeared. The dockside immigration official swore that he hadn't left the ship down the gangway. McDermott decided the only way for Sherman Nance to have left the ship was over the side when they pulled into harbor. After McDermott gave his report to insurance investigators, he was told that no crewman or officer named Sherman Nance was listed as having served on board the Emerald Dolphin. While the Earl of Wattlesfield stood by, the crew of the Deep Encounter homed in on the signal beacons of the drifting submersibles and lifted them back on board. Once they were secured, the two ships resumed their course toward Wellington. Dead tired, Pitt straightened up his cabin from the mess made by the 40 people who had somehow managed to pack into the small enclosure during the cruise ship's evacuation. His muscles ached, a condition he noticed creeping on him with age. He threw his clothes in a laundry bag and stepped into the small shower, turning on the hot water so it sprayed into one corner. As he lay on his back on the floor with his long legs extending up to the soap dish, in that position, he promptly dozed off for 20 minutes. Coming awake, fully refreshed but still sore, he soaped and rinsed before toweling dry, stepping out of the shower and staring into the mirror above the brass sink. He lightly ran the fingers of one hand over the several scars spread across his body, reminders of his many adventures during his 2 decades of service with the National Underwater and Marine Agency. Though he had attended the Air Force Academy and still held a commission as major in the Air Force, he had jumped at the chance to serve under Admiral James Sandecker and the newly formed Oceanographic and Marine Science Agency. Never married, he had come close during a long-running relationship with Congresswoman Lauren Smith, but his job at NUMA and hers in Congress were too demanding for marriage. Two of his former loves had died under tragic circumstances, Summer Moran in a devastating underwater earthquake off Hawaii, and Maeve Fletcher, shot by her sister off the coast of Tasmania. It was Summer who never ceased to haunt Pitt's dreams. He always saw her swimming into the depths to find her father, who was trapped in an underwater cavern, her lovely body and flowing red hair vanishing into the green water of the Pacific. When he'd reached the surface for air and found her gone, he tried to dive back, but the men in the boat that rescued him knew it was hopeless and physically restrained him from returning. Since that time, he had lived only for his work on and under the water. The sea became his mistress. Except for his home in an old aircraft hangar on one corner of Washington's Ronald Reagan Airport, which contained his car and airplane collection, he was always happiest when on a research ship sailing the oceans of the world. He sighed, put on a terrycloth robe, and lay down on his bed. He was about to drift off into a deserved sleep when the girl with her father's leather case jumped into his mind. The more he thought about it, the less it made sense that she had left in one of the container ship's boats without his seeing her. Then it became obvious. She hadn't left. She was still hiding somewhere on board the Deep Encounter. Ignoring the allure of sleep, he came off the bed and quickly dressed. 5 minutes later, he began his search at the stern end of the platform deck, peering into every nook and cranny in the generator room, winch room, propulsion motor room, and scientific equipment storeroom. He checked out the repair parts storeroom and almost missed it. That little something seemingly out of place. He noticed several gallon cans of various lubricating oils, all neatly stacked on a workbench. He knew they should have been stored in a wooden storage crate. He walked over to the crate and eased open the lid. Kelly Egan was sleeping an exhausted sleep so sound she did not perceive Pitt's presence. The leather case was propped against the side of the crate, and one of her arms hung over it. He smiled, removed a clipboard from a bulkhead hanger, tore off a page from the pad, and wrote a note. "Dear lady, when you wake, please come to my cabin on deck level 2, number 8. Dirk Pitt." As an afterthought to entice her, he added, "Food and drink will be waiting." He laid the note gently on her chest, softly closed the lid to the crate, and stepped from the parts room. At slightly past 7 in the evening, Kelly rapped lightly on Pitt's cabin door. She stood in the passageway, still clutching the handle of the leather case. "You must be starved," he said, smiling to show he wasn't angry or annoyed.
"Are you Dirk Pitt?"
"Yes, and you're..."
"Kelly Egan. I'm so sorry to have caused you..."
"No trouble at all," he interrupted. He motioned to a desk with a tray of sandwiches and a pitcher of milk. Not exactly a gourmet dinner, but about the best the cook could do with what's left of our food supply. As she ate, he sat down in a chair opposite her. "Feeling like you belong to the human race again?" She smiled and nodded, looking like a schoolgirl who had been caught in mischief.
"You must be wondering why I didn't leave the ship."
"The thought crossed my mind."
"I was afraid."
"Of what? The man who attacked you and your father? I'm happy to report that he joined the other victims of the ship who drowned."
"There was another one," she said hesitantly. "A ship's officer. He seemed to be an accomplice of the red-haired man who tried to kill me. Together they attempted to steal my father's case, but all they succeeded in doing was pushing him over the railing into the water."
Tears came to Kelly's eyes as she relived her father's death. Pitt reached in a pocket and handed her a handkerchief.
"Can you describe this officer?"
"Yes, he was a tall black man. It wasn't the first time Dad was harassed," she said angrily. "He told me of being threatened on several different occasions."
"So what is so important that your father had to die for it?" said Pitt, gesturing at the case, sitting on the deck at her feet.
"My father is..." she paused. "Was Dr. Elmore Egan. He was both a mechanical and chemical engineer."
"I'm aware of the name," said Pitt. "Dr. Egan was the creator of several different types of water propulsion engines. As I recall, he also formulated a highly efficient diesel fuel that is widely used in the transportation industry."
"You know that?" she asked, impressed.
"I'm a marine engineer. I'd get an F on the test if I hadn't heard of your father."
"Dad's latest project was the development of magneto-hydrodynamic engines," Kelly said.
"Like the propulsion units in the Emerald Dolphin." She nodded silently.
"What little I've read about magneto-hydrodynamic engines suggested the technology was still 30 years away. That's why I was surprised to read they had been installed in the Emerald Dolphin."
"Everybody was surprised. But Dad created a revolutionary design that compounded the electricity found in seawater before running it through a highly magnetic core tube that is kept at absolute zero by liquid helium. The electrical current that is produced then sets up an energy force that pumps the water through thrusters for propulsion."
Pitt was listening attentively.
"Are you saying that his engine's only outside fuel source is seawater?"
"Saline has a very small electrical field. My father discovered a method of intensifying it to an incredible degree to produce energy."
"It's hard to envision a means of propulsion with an inexhaustible source of fuel."
Kelly's face reflected pride in her father. "As he explained to me..."
"You don't work with him?" Pitt cut in.
"Hardly." She laughed for the first time. "I can't think in abstract terms. I never had it in me to conquer algebra. I majored in business at Yale, where I received my master's. I work as a merchandise analyst."
"What led your father to perfect the technology of magneto-hydrodynamic engines?"
"Early in his research, he reached a roadblock when his experimental engine exceeded power and energy expectations, but experienced extreme friction problems.
He and Josh Thomas, a respected chemical engineer, then formulated a new oil that was 100 times more efficient than any commercial oil available on the market today. Now Dad had a new power source that could run indefinitely without measurable wear for years.
So the super oil advanced your father's magneto-hydrodynamic engine from the drawing board to reality.
True, she acknowledged. After the pilot model's successful test program, the Blue Seas Cruise Lines directors approached Dad about constructing and installing his engines in the Emerald Dolphin, which was then under construction. They were also building an underwater luxury submarine passenger liner. They gave him an exclusive license to build the engines. He told me that he was working on an even greater project, something that would cause an unbelievable impact on the future.
Did he ever tell you what it was?
No, she answered. He was very secretive, and said it was better that I didn't know. Pitt sat thoughtfully quiet. Then he nodded toward the leather case.
Don't you think it's time you opened it?
She hesitated for a long moment. Then, very slowly, she clicked the latches and lifted the lid.
Oh, good Lord, she gasped.
Pitt sat up.
What is it?
As if in slow motion, she turned the case around and let it fall from her hands to the deck.
I don't understand, she whispered. It's never been out of my hands.
Pitt leaned down and peered inside the leather case.
It was empty.
The Earl of Waddlesfield sailed into Wellington 6 hours ahead of Deep Encounter and met with a joyous yet solemn welcome. Thousands of people lined the waterfront, staring silently as the container ship slowly eased into a berth. New Zealand's heart went out to those who had miraculously survived the worst ship fire in maritime history. If the arrival of the Earl of Waddlesfield was a melancholy affair, the welcome awaiting the Deep Encounter took on the atmosphere of a wild party. As the survey ship came through Cook Strait, it was met by a small fleet of private yachts that swelled to hundreds of vessels of every description by the time her bow nosed into the harbor. The crew and scientists had no idea they had become instant international celebrities and acclaimed heroes. They stood amazed at the resounding reception, unable to believe that it was for them. Pitt left the glory to Birch and the others. While they were feted in the city at hastily thrown together banquets, he remained aboard ship and gave a full report over his Global Star satellite phone to Admiral Sandecker in the NUMA headquarters building in Washington. The encounter took quite a beating, he explained. Moreover, to stay afloat, we had to jettison almost all our equipment into the sea.
The submersibles, too?
Sandecker's voice took on a serious tone. We set them adrift, but picked them up later.
Good. You're going to need them.
I don't follow you, Admiral. With half our underwater research gear lying on the seabed, there is no way we can carry out our original mission of mapping the Tonga Trench.
I don't expect you to map the trench. I expect you to dive on the Emerald Dolphin. Your job now is to survey what's left of her for evidence relating to the fire and the cause of her rapid sinking.
I'm not a fire insurance investigator. Just what exactly am I supposed to look for?
Don't worry, said Sandecker. I'm sending someone who has experience in marine disasters. He's also an expert in deep submergence vehicles.
Anybody I know? Asked Pitt.
You should, said Sandecker cagily. He's your assistant special projects director.
Al Giordino, Pitt exclaimed happily. I thought he was still working on the Atlantis project in the Antarctic.
Not anymore. He's in the air now and should be landing in Wellington tomorrow morning.
Albert Giordino trudged across the gangway leading from the top of the dry dock to the deck of the Deep Encounter, lugging an old-fashioned steamer trunk over a burly shoulder. The sides were covered with colorful labels advertising hotels in countries around the world. One hand clutched a strap of the metal trunk, while the other clutched an antique leather satchel. He paused at the top of the gangway, dropped his load, and gazed around the empty work deck. Giordino's shoulders were almost as wide as his body was tall. At 5 feet 4 inches and 175 pounds, he was all muscle.
His Italian ancestry was apparent in his olive skin, black curly hair, and walnut-colored eyes. Gregarious, sarcastic, and jovial, his cutting humor often made those in his presence either laugh or cringe. Friends since childhood, Pitt and Giordino had played on the same football teams in high school and at the Air Force Academy. Wherever one went, the other was sure to follow. Their adventures together above and under the sea had become legend. Unlike Pitt, with his aircraft hangar full of antique cars, Giordino lived in a condo with decor that would incite an interior decorator to suicide. For transportation, he drove an old Corvette. Besides his work, Al's passion was women.
"Ahoy the ship!" he shouted.
He waited before shouting again, as a figure walked out onto the bridge from the pilot house, and a familiar face stared down at him.
"Can you restrain yourself?" Pitt said in mock seriousness. "We don't take kindly to barbarians coming aboard an elegant vessel."
"In that case, you're in luck," said Giordino, flashing a vast smile. "You could use a vulgar rowdy to liven up the place."
"Stay put," Pitt said. "I'll come down." In a minute, they were unashamedly embracing like the old friends they were. Though Giordino was 3 times stronger, Pitt always delighted in lifting the shorter man off the ground. Pitt slapped his friend on the back. "The last I heard, you were engaged to be married." Giordino held up his hands in a helpless gesture.
"Sandecker took me off the project, and my lover was offered a job to decipher ancient writings in China. She didn't want to turn down the opportunity, so she flew off in the first plane to Beijing."
"I'm happy to see you can cope with rejection."
"Oh, well, it beats being beaten with a whip, having your tongue nailed to a tree, and thrown in the trunk of a 1951 Nash Rambler."
After Giordino had unpacked and settled in, he entered Pitt's cabin carrying a bottle of Don Julio Reserve, Blue Agave, Añejo tequila, and 2 sterling silver cups.
"Shall we test it and make sure it meets our qualifications?"
As they drank, Pitt filled Giordino in on what had happened to the Emerald Dolphin. Then they sat there until midnight, sipping the reserve tequila, telling old war stories, and reliving their adventures together throughout the years. Finally, Giordino rose to return to his cabin.
"When does the shipyard expect to have the hull repaired?"
"Captain Birch and I hope to get underway the day after tomorrow and be on site 4 days later."
"Time enough for me to regain the tan I lost in the Antarctic."
Giordino noticed the leather bag sitting in the corner of the cabin.
"Is that the case you mentioned that belonged to Dr. Regan?"
"The same."
Giordino picked it up and ran his fingers over the leather.
"Fine grain, quite old. German made. Egan had good taste."
"You want it?"
"You can have it."
Giordino sat down again and set the case on his lap.
"I have a thing about old luggage."
He unlatched the catches and lifted open the lid, and nearly 2 quarts of oil flowed out into his lap and onto the carpet covering the deck. After the shock faded, it gave Pitt a very acidic look indeed.
"I never knew you had a thing for practical jokes."
Pitt's face reflected pure astonishment.
"I don't, trust me. I had nothing to do with this. This case was empty when I checked it yesterday. I don't understand why somebody would bother to sneak in here and fill it with oil."
"Then where did it come from? It didn't just materialize."
"I haven't the foggiest idea," said Pitt. There was a strange look in his eyes. "But I'm betting we'll find out before the voyage is over."
The mystery of who put the oil in Egan's leather case was set aside as Pitt and Giordino began checking and testing the equipment and electronic systems of the Sea Sleuth, the survey vessel's autonomous underwater vehicle, or AUV. All agreed that for reasons of safety, the autonomous vehicle should be sent down first, rather than the manned submersible, Abyss Navigator. Utilitarian and expedient, the Sea Sleuth made a Mars lander look artistic. 7 feet high by 6 feet wide by 7 feet in length, she weighed in at slightly less than 7,000 pounds. Her skin was a thick layer of titanium, and from a distance, she looked like a huge elongated egg open on the sides, standing on sled runners. A complicated robotic arm, or manipulator, extended from one side of the vehicle. It had the muscle to lift a 400-pound anchor and the sensitivity to pick up a teacup. When the vehicle was 3 miles from the target, Birch, Pitt, and several other NUMA engineers and scientists gathered in the command center compartment just aft of the pilot house. They massed around the computer-enhanced screen, watching as the seabed 20,000 feet below unreeled as if on a scroll. Giordino sat in front of a console. He would pilot the Sea Sleuth during its journey into the abyss. Next to him, Pitt sat at the keyboard, entering a series of commands into the computer on board the AUV. While Giordino controlled the vehicle's propulsion and attitude systems, Pitt operated the cameras and lighting systems. To their side, Misty Graham sat at a table studying a copy of the Emerald Dolphin's construction plans. All other eyes were locked on the array of monitors that would relay images of what Sea Sleuth recorded in the depths. Misty was a petite woman, full of fire and vinegar, a dedicated scientist and one of the best marine biologists with NUMA. She spent far more time at sea than she did in her condominium in Washington. She looked up from the chart and spoke to Birch. If she's caved in on herself, Sea Sleuth won't have an easy time finding anything of interest. The Emerald Dolphin appeared to be broken in 3 places. Slowly, meticulously, they explored each of them, looking for clues to the fire. Descend down to 5 feet above the silt, Pitt told Giordino. I want to get a look at her keel. The Sea Sleuth followed Giordino's command and crawled around the bottom of the stern that sat nearly upright. Very cautiously, inching over and around debris, he stopped the vehicle and hovered it at a point where the ship's stern section was ripped open. They could see that the massive steel keel was warped and curled downward where it had been torn in half. Only explosives could have done that, Pitt commented. It's beginning to look like her bottom was blasted out, said Giordino. Her internal structure, weakened by the fire and the blast, broke apart from the increasing water pressure during her fall to the bottom. That would explain her abrupt sinking, added Birch. According to the tugboat captain, she went down so fast she almost took his boat with it. Which leads to the conclusion that someone had a motive for setting the ship afire and then sinking her in the deepest part of the ocean so her wreckage couldn't be examined.
So where does that leave us? Asked Misty.
Pitt stared thoughtfully at the monitors. Sea Sleuth has done its job and shown that the Emerald Dolphin did not destroy herself, nor was it an act of God. We have to dig deeper and come up with enough proof for an investigation. Proof that will lead to the doorstep of the murderous slime who is responsible for the loss of a beautiful ship and more than 100 lives. Dig deeper? Inquired Giordino, smiling as if knowing the answer. How? Pitt looked at his friend through Machiavellian eyes. You and I go down on the wreck ourselves, in the Abyss Navigator, and bring home the goods. A 4-man submersible, the Abyss Navigator's nerve center was a round titanium alloy ball that housed the pilot and the technician who controlled the life support systems, external lights, cameras, and 2 manipulator arms. The latter were mounted under the round hull and protruded like the special effects arms of a robot in a science fiction movie. A metal basket sat under the mechanical fingers to retrieve any artifacts picked off the bottom. Connected to the tubular framework around the manned ball were the pressure housings for the electronics, batteries, and communications equipment. The navigator was carrying 3 people. Misty Graham had joined Dirk and Al for 2 reasons. One, whatever project Misty tackled, she threw herself into with every ounce of her soul. After spending every free minute studying the deck plans of the Emerald Dolphin, she knew more about specific compartment locations than anyone on the survey ship. And 2, this was an opportunity for her to study the marine organisms of the deep. Once Pitt had loaded the cameras and checked them out, he monitored the life support system before positioning a small reclining seat for his lanky frame. He settled in for the long trip to the seabed by working a crossword puzzle. Occasionally, he looked up and peered out one of the viewports as the light from the surface above began to lose reds, greens, and yellows before turning a dark blue and finally pitch black. Beyond 2,000 feet, they encountered the world of bizarre sea life known as siphonophores, gelatinous predators that come in all shapes and sizes, some less than an inch, others that stretch to more than 120 feet. Misty was in her element as she stared entranced at the remarkably beautiful deep-water siphonophore. Like their jellyfish cousins that inhabited surface waters, they were delicately transparent and came in spectacularly luminescent colors with different characteristic light displays. Pitt was so absorbed by the drama outside his viewport that he never went back to his crossword puzzle. He turned from the port only when Giardino nudged him. Bottom coming up. Outside, the water was becoming filled with falling marine snow. Tiny, light gray particles, consisting of dead organisms and waste produced by the sea creatures above. Those inside the submersible felt as though they were driving through a light blizzard. "We have the bottom," Pitt alerted Giardino.
"You'll find her 200 yards southeast." Birch's voice came through the depths. "Follow a course of 140 degrees and you should come up on the aft end of the forward section where it tore away."
14 minutes later, the mangled wreckage came into view.
"Where to?" Giardino inquired.
Misty took several moments to study the interior deck plans of the Emerald Dolphin and get her bearings. Finally, she circled an area and passed it to Giardino.
"You want to go inside?" he asked Pitt,
knowing he'd be less than pleased with the answer.
"As far as we can go," Pitt replied. "If at all possible, I'd like to penetrate into the chapel where the crew reported the fire started."
He called up the deep encounter to report their situation, but there was no response. No voice replied over the speakerphone.
"Odd," he said, perplexed. "They're not answering." "The communications equipment probably malfunctioned," Giardino said calmly.
Pitt wasted no more time trying to raise the control center. They had an hour of bottom time left.
"Go on in," he ordered.
Already, sea life was probing the wreckage and setting up housekeeping. They spotted several rat-tailed fish, a species of shrimp, and what could only be described as a sea slug that had somehow wiggled its way into the jagged ruins. There was a mild current, but not enough to cause Giardino a problem in keeping the navigator steady. The dim outline of what was left of the decks and bulkheads came out of the gloom.
"Rise to the fourth deck," directed Misty. "It leads through a shopping mall to the chapel."
Slowly, Giardino maneuvered the sub upward using only the thrusters. At the deck Misty had indicated, he hovered the navigator while they stared inside the wreckage, now illuminated by the four forward lights. Melted pipes and electrical wiring hung down like distorted tentacles.
"We'll never get around that," said Giardino.
"Not around," Pitt contradicted, "but through. Run our bow against those pipes dead ahead." Without argument, Giardino eased the submersible into a maze of melted pipe. The pipes parted and crumbled, as if they were made out of poor-quality plaster of Paris, sending out a cloud of ashes that the sub easily slipped through.
"You call that right," muttered Giardino.
"I figured they'd be brittle after being subjected to intense heat." They soared through the charred wreckage of the shopping avenue. Nothing was left of the open three-deck avenue of stylish boutiques. Giardino cautiously navigated around and over the piles of debris that rose like a range of hills covered with jagged black lava rock.
"Coming to the site of the chapel," Misty notified them.
Pitt lay on his stomach and peered through the bottom viewport as Giardino covered the distance and then stopped the sub.
It hung over the space once occupied by the Emerald Dolphin's non-denominational chapel. The only distinguishing evidence that they were in the right area were melted floor mountings in rows that held the pews. With a light touch, Pitt moved the articulated manipulator arm downward until it began probing and sifting through the charred debris with its mechanical fingers. Clearing a 10-foot square area and finding nothing of interest, he glanced at Giardino. "Move his 5 feet forward." Giardino complied and sat patiently until Pitt asked him to maneuver the sub to another search grid. 30 minutes later, Pitt had sifted and examined most of the chapel area. As luck would have it, he found what he was looking for in the last grid. A strange-looking substance lay in a tiny, twisted lump on the deck. Less than 6 inches in length and 2 inches wide, it did not have the usual heat-fused look to it, but rather it appeared smooth and rounded. Its colors were odd, too. Instead of black or scorched gray, it had a greenish tint to it.
"Time is up," Giardino warned. "We don't have much oxygen in reserve to reach the surface safely."
"I think we may have found what we came for," said Pitt. "Give me another 5 minutes." Very tenderly, he worked the fingers of the manipulator and set the payload into the artifact basket. "Let's head for home." 3 hours later, the water began to turn from deep black to deep blue again as the colors of the spectrum returned. Looking through the overhead viewport, they could see the sea's restless surface shimmering and sparkling above. There were still no communications with the survey ship on the surface. They could not see the ship because all but one of the viewports were below. They waited for the divers to come and attach the lifting cable. But after 10 minutes, there was no sign of them.
"Why not crack the hatch and have a look?" Al asked.
Pitt swung the hatch on its hinge, crawled through, and stood with his head and shoulders above the hatch. Breathing in the fresh sea air and looking around for the survey ship and small boats with the dive recovery team. The seas were empty. Deep Encounter had vanished. The hijacking came so suddenly no one on Deep Encounter realized it was happening. The skipper of an oil company utility boat contacted Captain Birch, claiming he had an injured crew member and no medical supplies. As soon as several men had boarded Deep Encounter at Birch's invitation, they threw back the blankets on the litter they carried, snatched up automatic weapons that had been hidden beneath, and turned them on Birch's survey crew.
"We are confiscating your ship," said the tall, dark man, who appeared to be the leader of the group. "No one will be harmed."
Sandecker was working at his desk, so intent that he did not immediately notice that Rudy Gunn had entered the office and sat down across from him. Gunn was a little man with a genial disposition. The remaining wisp of hair across the top of his head, the thick horn-rimmed glasses, the inexpensive watch on his wrist, suggested a dull and colorless bureaucrat who slaved away unnoticed in a cubicle behind the water cooler. Gunn was anything but colorless. As assistant director and chief of operations, he was known to possess a brilliant mind coupled with a pragmatic instinct, and he ran the day-to-day operations of NUMA with an efficiency unknown in other government agencies.
"Sorry to interrupt, Admiral, but we have a serious problem. The Deep Encounter and all on board have vanished," he told the Admiral what had happened.
"How long has it been since they last responded?"
10 hours. Gunn braced himself for the outburst he was sure would come. Sandecker reacted as expected.
10 hours? My instructions are that all survey and research ships on station maintain status reports to our communications department every 2 hours.
Your instructions were carried out to the letter. Deep Encounter responded as scheduled.
You've lost me.
Someone claiming to be Captain Birch made contact every 2 hours and gave updated reports on the project. We know it was not the captain because our voice systems did not accept the voice patterns. Someone was attempting to imitate him.
Obtained from whatever source, NOAA or one of the security agencies, expanded satellite photos for a 1,000-square-mile grid of that part of the Pacific. I don't want to miss an inch.
After accepting the disappearance of the deep encounter in the vast emptiness of the sea, Pitt, Giordino, and Misty settled into the tight enclosure of their submersible and concentrated on staying alive. They found no trace of flotsam or an oil slick, so optimism overcame pessimism, and they assumed that for whatever reason the survey ship had sailed away and would soon return. But night passed. The sun rose and set twice more, and still no sign of the mother ship. Worry unfolded, and they began to suspect the worst when, hour after hour, their eyes scanned the limitless horizon and saw nothing but green sea and blue sky. No ship or even a high-flying jet liner made an appearance. Their onboard GPS told them they had drifted over the international dateline and were moving far south of the shipping lanes. Hope of a rescue dwindled. Water was the first priority. Fortunately, rain squalls were frequent. A vinyl mat that covered the floor of the sub was spread out and held over the hatch. It caught the rain and sent it down a crease into the water bottles they'd carried on the dive. After the sandwiches were consumed, they began a project for catching fish. Using tools carried on board for emergency repairs, Pitt fashioned a series of hooks, while Misty relied on her artistic talent for making colorful lures out of any material she could find. For fishing lines, Giordino disassembled electronic wiring and connected it to the hooks and lures. They cast out several lines and were rewarded with three small fish that Misty identified as frigate mackerel, which they quickly cut up, used for bait, and chummed in the water to attract more fish. They ate sushi-style down to the last morsel. The fourth day broke under gloomy skies. The routine never varied. Catch water if possible, catch fish if possible, and search the horizon. Each person stood a two-hour watch. During Misty's watch, an aircraft flew within a mile of the drifting submersible. Despite her frantic waving of the floor mat, the aircraft continued on. "It was a rescue plane," she cried. "He flew right over and didn't see us." "We're awfully hard to spot," Pitt reminded her. Three more planes flew over and failed to spot them. Pitt tried to hail them over the portable radio, but they were out of range. Giordino soon developed a flair for catnapping, and then coming awake 15 minutes later, almost to the minute. Sweeping the horizon and seeing no light for the 10th time that evening, he dropped off into his temporary dreamland. He woke to music. Initially, he thought he must be hallucinating. He reached over the side, scooped up a handful of seawater, and splashed it on his face. Out of the night came a Strauss waltz. He recognized it as Tales of the Vienna Woods. Then he saw a light. It looked like another star, but it was moving back and forth in a small arc on the western horizon. He jumped down through the hatch, groped for a flashlight, and climbed up again. Now he could see the vague outline of a small vessel and dim light showing through square windows. He switched the flashlight on and off as fast as his thumb could move the switch and yelled, "Over here! Over here!" "What is it?" Pitt called out below.
"Some kind of boat," Giordino shouted back. "I think he's headed our way."
Pitt tried to contact the vessel.
"Hello, hello, please respond," he implored.
His only reply was static. Suddenly a voice cracked over the submersible speaker.
"Who am I talking to?"
"Castaways," Pitt snapped back. "You sailed right past us. Please, reverse course."
"Hold tight. I'm coming around."
Giordino stared aghast at the brightly lit vessel bearing down on him. It looked like no ocean-going yacht he'd ever seen. It was shaped like a great green and white manta or devil ray, with its cephalic forward fins encircling its huge plankton-gathering mouth. A wide-sloping deck on the bow swept up and around a large arched picture window and then past a circular wheelhouse. Giordino gazed in awe as the underhull of the main superstructure moved overhead slowly until the submersible was directly between twin catamaran hulls. Almost on reflex, he grabbed a chrome ladder built like a small staircase
that abruptly appeared less than 2 feet away. Only then did he think to bend down and report to Pitt and Misty.
"It's a catamaran. We're directly under his stern."
Then he disappeared. For a few moments, they stood alone on the deck of the catamaran. The boat moved forward as the helmsman steered the vessel clear of the submersible. After traveling 200 yards, the boat slowed and drifted. They watched as a figure stepped down from the wheelhouse. He was a large man, the same height as Pitt, but 15 pounds heavier. He was also 30 years older. His gray hair and beard gave him the appearance of an old waterfront wharf rat. His blue-green eyes had a glint to them, and he readily smiled as he examined his catch.
"Three of you," he said in amazement. "I thought there was only one in that little life raft."
"Not a life raft," Pitt said. "A deep ocean submersible." He studied the old man.
"We've met before." "Yes, I suspect we have."
"My name is Dirk Pitt," he introduced the others. The old man warmly shook hands with all. Then he turned and grinned at Pitt.
"I'm Clive Cussler."
Pitt looked at the old man curiously.
"You get around."
"I'm on a round-the-world cruise," Cussler said. "I'm bound for Papeete, Tahiti, but I guess I'd better make a detour and set you folks on the nearest island with an airport."
"And where would that be?" asked Giordino.
"Rarotonga."
Pitt looked around the luxurious catamaran.
"I see no crew."
"I'm sailing alone," answered Cussler.
"On a motor yacht this large?"
Cussler smiled. "The Periwinkle isn't your average yacht. Between her automated systems and computers, she can sail herself, and usually does."
Cussler led the way up a stairway to the wheelhouse. None of the Numa people had ever seen anything like it. The tinted windows ran in a 360-degree circle, providing vision on every horizon. There were no conventional instruments or gauges, no wheel for a helm or throttle levers. A large, overstuffed executive chair sat in front of 7 LCD liquid crystal display screens. The chair's right arm held a computer trackball, while the left armrest was fitted with a joystick. The screens were all encased in burled walnut cabinets. Cussler motioned for Pitt to sit in the helm chair.
"The Global Star phone is mounted in the panel to your right. Just press the blue button and you can all speak to your party on the other end."
Pitt thanked him and dialed up Sandecker's private line at Numa headquarters. The Admiral answered on the first ring.
"Admiral, this is Dirk."
Pitt could hear the Admiral's sigh of pleasure when he was assured that they were all alive and well.
"I've got Rudy here in my office," he said. "I'll switch to the speaker."
Then he told them,
"We can't be absolutely certain, but it's beginning to look like the Deep Encounter was hijacked."
"But why?" questioned Giordino. "What earthly good is an oceanographic survey ship to pirates? Where's the motive?"
"Motive." Pitt let the word slide off his tongue and hang in the air. "The same people who torched the cruise ship and then sank her wanted to prevent us from discovering evidence of arson." Misty's eyes suddenly looked stricken.
"Which brings us to the horrible possibility that everyone on the Deep Encounter has been killed."
There was silence on the yacht and 10,000 miles away in Washington. They were all loath to consider the prospect.
"Rudy," Pitt said, "the pirates could have just as easily sunk the Deep Encounter after they captured it, but you say they faked voice transmissions of Birch. Why would they have bothered to stall off any suspicion if the ship was already sunk? My guess, my fervent hope, is that they took the ship and everyone on board and hid them as bargaining chips should their plans go wrong."
"If what Dirk suggests is accurate," said Misty, distressed, "we only have a little time to save our friends."
"I'll bet I know how to find both ships," said Pitt. "We'll expand our search grid."
Sandecker's voice was skeptical.
"We increased the range and path of the satellite cameras, but there was still no sign of Deep Encounter."
Pitt played his wild card. "True, but you were looking on the water."
"Where were we supposed to look?" asked Sandecker, becoming intrigued.
Dirk has a point, said Gunn thoughtfully. We didn't consider focusing the cameras on land.
Forgive me for asking, Giordino spoke up, but what land? The nearest landmass from where the cruise liner sank is the northern tip of New Zealand.
No, said Pitt, quietly for effect. There are the Kermadec Islands, no more than 200 nautical miles to the south, an easy 8-hour sail at a speed of 25 knots. He turned and looked at Cussler. Are you familiar with the Kermadec Islands?
I've cruised around them, answered Cussler. Not much to look at. Raoul Island is the largest, but it's only a pile of rock 13 miles square with lava rock cliffs. There's a small meteorological and communication station there, but it's automated. Scientists only visit it every 6 months to check and repair the equipment.
Is there a harbor large enough to anchor a small ship?
More like a lagoon, replied Cussler. But it's a safe anchorage for 2, maybe 3 small ships.
Is there any possibility you could make a detour by the Kermadecs? Pitt asked. The malachite green sea merged with the peridot green water flowing through the channel of the large lagoon that nestled between the volcanic lava cliffs of Raoul Island. From the sea, only a tiny section of the lagoon could be seen through the chasm, whose cliffs rose on each side of the channel. It was like peering through a telescope into a distant, narrow slit. High atop the west side of the entrance, more than 300 feet above the surf, a small shack built of palm fronds perched dangerously close to the edge. The native look was a facade. A security guard sat inside a comfortable little house, studying the vast expanse of ocean with a large pair of binoculars mounted on a stand. He swung the binoculars and focused on the strangest-looking yacht he had ever seen, cutting through the sun-danced water at what he guessed as close to 40 knots. On the upper open deck, two people, a man and a woman, lounged in a jacuzzi, drinking out of tall glasses and laughing. All windows were tinted, and he could not see any suggestion of other crew members or passengers. He turned to the radio, switched on the transmitter, and began speaking.
This is Pirate. I have a private yacht approaching from the northeast.
Any sign of weapons or armed personnel?
Replied a voice like sandpaper.
None.
She doesn't look threatening?
Asked the rough voice.
Not unless you consider 2 naked people in a jacuzzi threatening.
He gazed at the boat through the glasses again, watching until it became a tiny speck in the distance. Then he called over the radio.
This is Pirate. The yacht is gone. It appears as if she dropped anchor in the open lagoon on the south end of Macaulay Island.
Then she's harmless, said the rough voice. Watch her lights after dark, and make sure she stays put.
Misty and Giordino were not naked in the hot tub. They were wearing swimsuits provided by Cussler. They were, however, sipping rum Collinses as the boat cruised under the steep palisades of Raoul Island. Cussler and Pitt were not as lucky. The old man sat at the helm station with a chart in his lap, eyeing the depth sounder and examining the bottom coral reefs that could have sliced the Periwinkle's twin hulls like razor blades through cardboard. Pitt lay sweating under a pile of pillows and towels on the lower lounge deck, videotaping the guardhouse at the top of the cliffs overlooking the channel entrance. Once the yacht was anchored, they all settled into the main salon and gazed at the monitor while Pitt played the tape on the VCR. The telephoto lens on the camera, combined with the video enhancement, revealed the guard peering at them through a pair of huge binoculars. Added to the video was the soundtrack of the conversation between the guard and his colleague, as recorded by Cussler's high-tech communication system. "We fool them," said Misty.
"What happens now?" Cussler asked.
"As soon as it's dark, we build a small raft and attach lights on it so it looks like a boat lit up from a distance. Then we sail back under cover of the cliffs near the channel, just out of sight of the guard. Then Al and I will go in the water and take a swim up the channel to the lagoon to have a look around. If we're right,
and the deep encounter is hidden under camouflage netting, we sneak aboard, overpower the hijackers, free our friends, and sail off into the blue. Misty looked dumbstruck.
You can't be serious. The two of you going up against 50 or more armed hijackers? That's the craziest scheme I've ever heard.
Pitt shrugged. I admit I may have oversimplified things just a shade, but I really don't see any other way of handling the job.
You'll have a long swim, said Cussler. I have a dive thruster that will pull you through the water. You can use it to propel you both in tandem.
Beginning just after sunset, it took the three men 2 hours to tie several palm tree trunks together into a raft and then construct a rough outline of the periwinkle with framing scrounged from driftwood. For a finishing touch, a small battery was connected to a string of lights on the framework. Then the raft was anchored on the shore side of the yacht.
"It ain't pretty," said Giordino, "but it should fool the security guard sitting in his little hovel 5 miles away."
Cussler shifted the lights to the raft and threw the yacht into darkness. He steered toward Raoul Island by radar, watching carefully to see if the boat was stirring up any phosphorescence in her wake.
"I'll bring us inside the outcropping of rocks just in front of the channel," he explained. "From there, you'll have to rely on the thruster."
Pitt and Giordino dropped into the warm, ink-black water with only a slight splash and swam a short distance from the boat. After stroking for several minutes, they paused and looked back. Once past 100 feet, the periwinkle became invisible. Giordino wrapped his arms around Pitt's legs and hung on as the thruster was switched on and the jets began pulling them through the water at nearly 3 knots. In less than 15 minutes, they passed under the high cliffs into the open lagoon. Pitt angled the thruster off to the side of the beach and kept the power on until he could feel sand beneath his feet. Only then did he shut it down. There was no indication of inhabited structures on the beach, but the lagoon was far from deserted. Two vessels lay moored side by side in the middle. Leaving the thruster on the beach, they swam toward the larger of the two ships. She was anchored with her bow facing into the channel. From the dim light of an open port, Pitt could just barely make out the name on the welded letters on the bow. Deep Encounter. Giordino gazed upward. "How do we get aboard without a gangplank or a ladder?"
"We don't."
"Naturally, you have an alternate plan." Pitt's slight grin was lost in the darkness. "The hijacker's ship is smaller. We can probably go over the stern, then work our way on board Deep Encounter." He'd guessed right. The pirate's vessel was no sailing ship bristling with muzzle-loading guns, but a 135-foot utility workboat whose stern was not only low enough for them to struggle aboard, but showed them all the consideration in the world by providing a diver's boarding ladder and a small platform. He was in the act of climbing over the stern railing when Giordino's fingers dug into his arm.
"Someone's standing in the shadows by the aft deckhouse smoking a cigarette."
Giordino spoke softly in Pitt's ear.
Quiet as a wraith, Giordino climbed over the stern railing, padded silently across the deck, and hooked those big hands around the man's neck, cutting off all air to the lungs. There was a brief struggle, and then the body went limp. With only a slight whisper of sound, he dragged the hijacker back to the stern and behind a large winch. Pitt searched through the man's clothing, discovering a large folding knife and a snub-nosed revolver. "We're in business," he proclaimed. Without another word, they crossed the expansive cargo and work deck at a steady, unhurried pace. They halted before coming to the gangplank between the two ships and sneaked a look inside one of the ports that had a light issuing through it. Pitt counted 22 of the hijackers sitting around in a large mess room playing cards, reading, or watching satellite television. There were enough guns stacked around to start a revolution. Again, they moved soundlessly across the deck before Pitt suddenly stopped. He pointed to the wide patch of painted cardboard that was crudely taped on the side of the superstructure. "Let's see what they're hiding." Slowly, he peeled off the duct tape that held the cardboard on the metal side. He could just discern the stylized image of a three-headed dog with a serpent for its tail. Directly beneath was the word Cerberus. It meant nothing to him, so he pushed the cardboard cover back in place and retaped it.
"See anything?" Giardino asked.
"Enough." They continued to the gangplank and stepped over the water onto the deck of the survey ship. Now Pitt was on home ground. He could easily make his way along the decks of the Deep Encounter blindfolded. He went into the communications room and picked up the Global Star phone and dialed Sandecker's cell phone number. Time was too short for Pitt to say anything vague to throw off anyone homing in on the call. He gave the Admiral a brief, concise report on finding the Deep Encounter and gave its exact location.
"My crew and scientific team?" asked the Admiral, as if they were members of his immediate family.
"The issue is still in doubt," answered Pitt, repeating Major Devereaux's famous message just before the fall of Wake Island.